Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel. We have a busy docket, so let's get right to it. First on the docket, oh, how the mighty have fallen. That's right, Governor Cuomo resigns. Will he still be charged criminally? Who is Lori Vallow's new attorney? Barry Morphew's preliminary hearing continues. Prosecutors tell Josh Duggar's defense team this is a simple case. Let's meet the man who's charged with the death of Officer Ella French. And is this a case of karma? And then finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for watching. If you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button as well as hit that little bell so that you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. Well, what is today? Today is Tuesday, and that means we have our Tuesday night live. Now, normally we would have our Patreon tonight, but due to a scheduling conflict, we're going to have to do our Patreon show another night this week. All right, let's get straight to the docket. That's right. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, the man who rose to the top, so to speak, well, his star has fallen for sure. He was hit with a barrage of sexual harassment and even sexual assault allegations that are still being investigated. Now, the allegations include groping of the breasts and buttocks of people, which is certainly inappropriate. And the governor basically tried to shame the victim, saying that they're all wrong. He does this all the time. He would never do this. The classic defense, which is, well, meet all these other people that I never did anything to. Therefore, your allegations must be false. No. Doesn't matter. And here we have conflicting allegations. And if the prosecutors decide to go forward, even if it is a misdemeanor unlawful sexual contact case, it is ultimately a question of fact for the jury to decide. That's what juries do, decide questions of fact. The accuser says something happened, the defendant says it didn't. Let the jury decide, see who is telling the truth. Now, this goes back to one of the 12 undeniable truths from a criminal defense attorney. Rule number one, there's two types of people in the world, those that are humble and those that are about to be. I've repeated this numerous times. It's absolutely true. Governor Cuomo, had he been a little more humble, I doubt that he would be receiving such resistance from even his own party these days and even the president telling him to resign. We'll see if charges are brought. Let me know if you think the prosecutions should move forward, or do you think he's going to get a pass because, well, he's a Cuomo in the state of New York. Next on the docket, Lori Vallow has a new attorney. Now, we talked about it in pretty good detail last week on our Tuesday night live show about the ABA standards for an attorney to be death qualified on a case where the death penalty would be sought. Clearly, Mr. Mark Means does not have those qualifications, frankly, not even close. And I opined that it wouldn't surprise me if there would be a new attorney appointed, and guess what? The judge has in fact done that. The judge, Stephen Boyce, appointed Jim Archibald on the case. Now, he apparently is a seasoned public defender, and he has now been appointed, and he is apparently one of the few death penalty certified attorneys in Eastern Idaho. That is good. So he will more than likely become the lead counsel. Now, I think it's also very interesting that the court, even though these proceedings are stayed, appointed new counsel. Clearly, the court believes that Lori Vallow will be restored to competency, and let's have the attorney ready, willing, and able to proceed. Now, we checked the court website, and nothing about this appointment on the court website, but things seem to be moving rather slowly, and they don't seem to always give us as much information as well. Frankly, I think the public should know. Now, obviously, I don't know anything about Mr. Archibald other than what I've learned recently. Apparently, very experienced, done death penalty cases, and is very seasoned defense attorney, which is good. We always want everyone accused of a crime to have a seasoned defense attorney for the simple reason that eliminates post-conviction issues down the road. Now, Mark Means is still listed as the lead counsel, but I don't think that is going to be lasting much longer. So if you watched our show yesterday, you knew that Frank and I, along with his father, jumped into Crime Talk One, flew into the Idaho Falls Airport, very nice FBO there. I think it was called Aramark Aviation, top notch, treated us great, great facilities as well. Anyway, they were able to have a car waiting for us when we landed. We jumped in the rental car, drove up to Rexburg, checked things out. We're able to talk to some people in the community. And I'm telling you, nice, nice community. Now, Madison County has some 40,000 residents. It's right there on the cusp of 39, 40,000 people. I think they're going to be able to find a jury in that jurisdiction. I don't see a change of venue proceeding. The people that we were able to talk to while we were there yesterday in Rexburg seem to be aware of the case. I don't think they're following all of the details as maybe as our Crime Talk aficionados do. However, they basically have stated that they could listen to the evidence that's presented. And so we'll see what evidence is presented by the defense in their change of venue request. But at this point, I think they're going to be able to do it. Now, here's another thing. The Rexburg community, very, very nice. The place is spotless. Not like oftentimes you see in the big city, so to speak. Madison County, which has Rexburg and another city that I can't remember at this time, but very nice, very clean. It looked like something out of Central Casting movie set, drop in, Western United States rural community. Nice as could be. And it seems like at least all the people that we ran into, it seemed like every one of them would know how to operate a backhoe. And I don't mean that as in a derogatory way, because I wish I knew how to do that. I mean, just people that just know how to work, follow the rules, and just very nice people. Frank, would you agree with that?
Yep.
All right. See, Frank agrees too. So nice place. We'll probably be back in Idaho Falls. Rexburg had a little airport literally right in the center of town, but it didn't have a very long runway. I like long runways with control towers. So if we had to go in there, we could do it, but maybe next time. All right. Let's talk now about the Barry Morphew matter. Preliminary hearing was yesterday, and as we told you, our young producer, that's right, Julie, is actually in Salida in the courthouse. She was the second person to line up yesterday to make sure that she was able to get into the courthouse, and she is tweeting in the courthouse as things, breaking news develops. You can follow her tweets on the Crime Talk with Scott Reich Twitter handle at Crime Talk Pod, P-O-D. So yesterday, the big issues and some things that don't actually make it into the newspapers is that apparently the defense wanted to make an opening statement, and the judge said, nope, not necessary, denied that. The first witness yesterday was an Officer Alex Walker. He was the one who showed up and found the bicycle. Basically said that when they found Suzanne Morphew's bicycle, there was no damage to it. It was this mountain bike. There weren't any tracks leading to or where the bike was found. No skid marks, no signs of a struggle, no brake marks, anything of that nature. There was no blood at the scene. Apparently, at some point, a search for Suzanne was conducted, but nothing was found. There were various exhibits played. For example, when Barry made a statement that maybe it was a mountain lion, things of that nature. The prosecution, understand, only has to show probable cause. And basically, from what I've seen so far, I don't think this is the strongest case ever for the prosecution, but I am willing to reserve judgment and see what evidence comes out. Remember, the prosecution does not have to present all their evidence at the preliminary hearing, simply enough for the case to be bound over to the district court. Probable cause, would a reasonable person believe that a crime was committed by the defendant? That's it. Not a huge hurdle for the prosecution to get over at this stage of the proceedings, particularly when the evidence must be viewed in light most favorable to the prosecution. And understand, the judge in the preliminary hearing is also the judge that, well, granted the arrest warrant on the 125-page affidavit. The big news of the day yesterday was that Suzanne Morphew was engaging in an extramarital affair. Well, and she was also concerned that Barry Morphew was engaging in extramarital affairs, and she was recording their conversations on a pen recorder. Now, it is what it is. This is no sort of victim shaming whatsoever. It just simply shows the reality of life. People can be in a relationship. They have children. Maybe they stay together for the children. Maybe when they go off to college, they call it quits. But the reality of it is that it took place. Now, the interesting point is that the other guy in this particular relationship didn't come forward at all when Suzanne Morphew went missing with, like, maybe I have some information. At first blush, it sounded like maybe there was some sort of alternate suspect. But this individual who lived in Michigan, apparently the police checked it out. His cell phone pinged in Michigan at or about the time Suzanne Morphew disappeared. He was apparently building a dock and had actually gone to the hardware store. So he was basically eliminated as a suspect. It'll be interesting to see if the defense somehow tries to implicate this particular individual. He's still married and has, that's right, six children. The afternoon session yesterday, basically not a whole lot of new information, a lot of text messages between Suzanne Morphew and her friend about being concerned about being with alone with Barry Morphew. Going back to this other gentleman, this man was identified by the name of Jeff Lebler. He apparently was a high school friend of Suzanne Morphew, and they somehow reunited. They were able to have several interactions in other states, and they were communicating via text, WhatsApp, and LinkedIn. And when Suzanne Morphew went missing, he deleted all of his files and accounts where they were text messaging. Not saying he did something wrong, but it certainly looks a little odd and he didn't come forward with some sort of information, regardless of the fact that you may have marital problems on your own home front. It would seem like it would possibly be the thing to do. Now, today there was some testimony regarding secret bank accounts that Suzanne Morphew had. Apparently, the investigators did not go into that. Apparently, Barry and Suzanne Morphew paid for a lot of things in cash. A safe was seized as part of the search warrant, but apparently some $70,000 was missing from the safe when it was opened. It's not exactly sure how they came to that figure or why they think it should have been that way. Some text messages have been brought out, and the defense was objecting in regards to anything regarding Barry Morphew looking for other girlfriends, so to speak, on the side. There was a text that said, quote, "I'm done. I could care less what you've been doing for years. We need to figure this out civilly." That was a text on May 6th of 2020. Then there was some testimony regarding when Barry Morphew arrived home on May 9th. And the police have information, basically, when the car was started, when it backed up, what door opened up. This is all apparently available in the vehicle's black box information. It's amazing how much information you can get these days. And that the car left about 3:25 on May 10th. They have the driver door opens and closes, the end of the driveway at 3:58. Cell phone moves from that residence up until where 225 and Highway 50 intersect. But the experts, apparently, for the phone data interpretation cannot confirm any further movement. Barry's phone appears back into airplane mode, at the residence at 537 in Buena Vista as he's on his way north to Broomfield. He was texting his mother at 538 saying Happy Mother's Day. At 636 from Bailey, Colorado, Barry texts Suzanne, "You up? Happy Mother's Day. I love you." The phone for Barry Morphy once again shows up at an RTD bus stop in Broomfield at 8:10 a.m. There apparently is a trash bin at this site. Barry said he did throw away something, but he wasn't sure. He stopped for a minute and a half, and that is trash run number one. Apparently, there were at least three other trash runs. And there's photographs of Barry walking through the doors at the hotel at 8:25 a.m., and he's holding something small in his hands. Surveillance shows him carry multiple items up to the room in his left hand. Looks like hiking boots of some type, a light blue garment, and a dark black piece of clothing and a bag. Barry Morphy allegedly made three trips to the trash can. Then he drives to the men's warehouse parking lot in the Broomfield area, spent 40 minutes there, the passenger and driver's door open and closed multiple times with breaks in between. There's no surveillance at that time. Now, there's some conflicting information. One states that Barry's in his room between 12:42 and 5:55 p.m. on this particular day, and that he texts Suzanne at 3:30. And then at 5:15, Barry received a call from a neighbor. This apparently conflicts with the Colorado Bureau investigation statement that they received from him, where he originally stated on May 13th that he was at the work site when he got the call. Now, he left the room at 5:55. His shirt is changed again. He changed his statement by April of 2021 and says he was in the room, but won't say what he was doing. At 6 p.m., he's shown to have a shovel and rake in his hands entering the hotel. He places all the tools in the hotel lobby for his workers. Nothing electric, all hand tools. That's all we had for today before the break was taken. If there's new breaking information, we'll talk about it when we go live tonight at 6 p.m. This case is going to get interesting. Barry Morphew has two very, very skilled attorneys. They are definitely trying to go for the win, even though it's going to be very, very difficult for the prosecution to have this case kicked out. It's very clear that that's what the defense is trying to do. Hopefully, for the prosecution, they have some better evidence, because as of right now, I'm just simply not sure what I've seen is going to be enough to ultimately get a murder conviction. We'll see. My opinion may change if, well, the evidence gets a little more overwhelming. But as of right now, it looks kind of weak. Please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched, and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever, but if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship. You're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. Next on the docket, the prosecutors tell the defense attorney for Josh Duggar, that's right, rhymes with hugger, this is a simple case. Get over it. What does the defense want? The defense wants to know exactly how these images came to be identified and given to the prosecutors. Well, the prosecutor says, hey, this information was basically sent to us. We received it. We conducted our own investigation. It's irrelevant how it originally got to us. And in fact, the prosecutor went into painstaking detail as to the evidence that was found, and that this little red herring that the defense wants to go down and create for the court to engage in is completely irrelevant. Now, I could go through and detail, as the prosecutor did in their affidavit, with great graphic nature of the photos of young prepubescent children. But I'm not going to do that. Well, It's just simply not necessary. I'm sure you get the picture. Next on the docket, another Chicago police officer was killed the other day. The officer, Ella French, she was 29 years old and apparently was coming back from maternity leave, so literally has a two-month-old child. Her partner was also shot, but the officer survived. And this story is rather interesting because, well, first, the individuals that have been charged, first, Imonte Morgan, 21 years old. He was booked on the charges of actually being responsible for the death of Officer Ella French. Now, his brother, Eric Morgan, another man, also faced charges of the same incident. Police describe a situation where French and her partner pull over a car with three occupants on Saturday. The stop was for expired plates, and according to the police, Morgan was the male passenger in the vehicle, and there was a struggle that went from the trunk of the vehicle to the near the inside of the car, according to the police reports. As it's described, shots rang out from the passenger side front seat. Morgan fatally shot French, according to the police. Officers fired back, striking one of the individuals in the vehicle. Now, Morgan is charged with one count of first-degree murder, one count of unlawful use of a weapon by a felon, which, I mean, it's surprising that a felon would have a weapon because it's nearly impossible for law-abiding citizens to have weapons in the city of Chicago. So I'm not exactly sure how that happened. Perhaps that is a typographical error in this news story or not. He also allegedly shot French's partner, putting him in critical condition. French's partner was a six-year veteran of the department, and he has not been identified as of yet. He apparently is getting better, but is still in critical condition. Now, authorities say that another individual by the name of Jamel Danzy bought the gun at issue in Indiana on behalf of Eric Morgan, who knew he could not buy the gun because of his felony record. He is charged with knowingly transferring and giving a firearm to an out-of-state resident and knowingly disposing of a firearm to a convicted felon. Funny how that works, isn't it? Now, I think the thing that is rather interesting in this case is that the mayor, that's right, Mayor Lightfoot, went to the hospital to see the officer. There were some 30 officers at the hotel, including the other officer's father, who is a retired Chicago police officer. And guess what? They all turned their backs on the mayor as she came to the hospital, kind of like what she has done for law enforcement. Now, let's face it, the Chicago police have not exactly had the best reputation of the years for being the most upstanding police department in the country, but it only gets better when you support the good police officers and get rid of the bad ones. Now, the mayor tried to basically say emotions are high and we understand, but she was doing her duty. We'll see if Mayor Lightfoot sticks around for a second term. Somehow, I don't think she's exactly winning the hearts and minds of the citizens of Chicago. Next on the docket, is this a case of karma? Well, I would think possibly. So Shane Goldsby, he is 26 years old, and he was already serving a prison sentence, and now he just got another 298-month sentence. That's about 24 years. Why did he get a 24-year sentence on top of his original sentence? That's right. Well, he killed his cellmate. Well, that's shocking, Scott. Why would an inmate kill his other cellmate? Well, I've seen it for as little as a cup of ramen noodle or somebody snored. That's right. That kind of things happen. But in this particular case, the victim was a guy by the name of Robert Munger. Well, and he was serving a 43-year sentence for the sexual assault of a child. That child just happened to be Mr. Goldsby's sister. So when Mr. Goldsby found out who his cellmate was, at one point he actually asked to be moved out of the cell. The prison officials had no idea as to the connection and denied the request, whereupon Mr. Goldsby took it upon himself to attack Mr. Munger. In a common area, he punched him some 14 times, then kicked and stomped him. Mr. Munger died 3 days later from his injuries. Is that a case of karma or what? Mr. Munger, a lot of people would say you've had it coming, but a lot of people would say it's never right to harm anyone. You decide. Let me know. 24 years a little too harsh or just about right? And then finally today, we have our dumb criminal contestant of the day. This is our, I think, second false alarm that has been called in. Well, an unidentified woman, 21 years old, had her father call in a 911 bomb threat. Why, you may ask? Because there was really a bomb? No. She just didn't want to be at work and she wanted to go home. The father, of course, didn't know that the bomb threat was fake and complete fabrication for his daughter. But he called it in, and of course, the police ultimately found out that it was a false alarm and complete fabrication. So our dumb criminal has not been charged yet, and they have also not released her name, which is something I think they should do. I think because a little public shaming would go a long way. If a 21-year-old thinks that the best way of getting out of work is by calling in a fake bomb threat, my gosh, they're just not a dumb criminal contestant. They're just dumb. And lazy. Well, and dumb. All right. That's all we have for you today. Please join us this evening, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, when we go live. We have a lot to talk about. We can talk about my trip to Rexburg, Idaho yesterday, as well as obviously the Barry Morphew preliminary hearing. We'll see you tonight. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you next time on Crime Talk.